This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Natalia Shpilova-Said. I'm a host of New Books in Literary Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm delighted to speak today with Kieran Pem about his recent book, Endless Flight, The Life of Joseph Roth, published by Granta Book in 2022. Kieran Pem is a nonfiction author. His previous book was about a man who connected the worlds of art, rock and roll, and criminality in 50s and 60s London. That book, Jumping Jack Flash, David Litvinov, and the Rock and Roll Underworld, was named the best debut biography of the year in The Guardian. Aside from writing biographies, Kieran Pem is the author of popular science book about dinosaurs and the editor of a volume of medieval Hebrew poetry. He also works as a writing tutor, journalist, proofreader, and copy editor. His journalism for national titles includes a cover story for The Guardian's Weekend magazine and book reviews for The Guardian, The Daily Telegraph, and The Spectator. Kieran Pem teaches creative writing courses at the University of East Anglia. Hello, Kieran. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hello, Natalia. It's a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you very much.
Congratulations on this new biography. Endless Flight tells the story of Joseph Roth, and this story is fascinating for many reasons. One of the intriguing things is that his life appears to be tightly connected with political and historical developments that took place during his lifetime. So, when did you encounter Joseph Roth for the first time, and how did the idea to write a book on Joseph Roth transpire?
Okay, I first encountered his work in 2002 or three. It was when his book, The Wandering Jews, was first published in English translation, published by Granta, translated by Michael Hoffman. And that book was recommended to me by my cousin, who thought that I would find it interesting. And I did. I found it fascinating, not only as a survey of the situation of Jewish communities within Europe in the 1920s when he was writing it, but also for what it told us or what it didn't tell us about the author. You came away with a rather haunted sense of this man who was semi-present in the text, but also not quite. One of the best known bits of the book is when he goes to Galicia and goes to a little town, goes to a shtetl and describes the people that he encounters there, the wonder rabbi that he meets, the Hasidic Jews that he encounters and their lifestyles, their rituals, their traditions. And what you don't read, what you're not told, is that actually this was the world that he came from. This was the world that Joseph Roth actually originated from. But he writes about it rather as if he was a kind of intrepid reporter from afar, exploring on behalf of all of us who were not from that world, which by then he was in a way, because by then, this book was published in 1927, by then he was kind of well established in Vienna and Berlin mm-hmm. and Paris. He was known in all these places as a novelist and journalist. And he had tried to assimilate into these places. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, he had kind of left behind the world of the Ostjude and the Eastern Jews that he originated in. And yet there's clearly some kind of knowledge, some fascination on his part. Clearly this world still has a hold over him. So the way he writes about it is so beguiling and fascinating and makes you think, well, who is this man? He's kind of intimate with the story, with the world he's describing, and yet he doesn't quite make that explicit in the text. So I was fascinated and haunted by that. I thought, this is a man, this is a writer I would like to know more about. I didn't really do much about that for quite a while until I'd finished writing my last book, which was published in 2016. And then after that, I started thinking about what I might do next. And I started thinking again about this writer who had fascinated me when I read him, I guess, about 13, 14 years before. And I started reading around him a bit more, and I Googled him, and I kind of got all the more fascinated. And one of the things that I read was a review of his collected letters, again translated by Michael Hoffman, a review by Lyra Feigl in The Guardian, which said that there was no English biography of him, and the collected letters, which trace the trajectory of his life, would stand as his biography. And I thought, well, that's very interesting. There's a major writer mm-hmm. who doesn't have a biography in English. I thought, I wonder if I could do something about that. So I started reading around more intensively from there. And the more I read, the more fascinated I became. And the project gained momentum from there, really. And here I am, several years on. That was 2017. So, yeah, it's been about 5.5 years. Mm-hmm. And here I am now, and I have quite a bulky book about Joseph Roth's life as the end product of all of that reading and research and thinking about his work and his life.
Do you have any algorithm for compiling a biography? So do you have some sort of a strategy that helps you probably to systematize all the material? But as we can imagine, it involves a lot of reading and a lot of material that has to be somehow put together in order to create this nice portrait, right, of those on whom you write biographies.
Sometimes the system seems more apparent in retrospect, I think. Mm-hmm. You kind of look back over what you've done and think, oh yeah, I can see now, the kind of routes that I followed. But sometimes it's a combination of having a kind of route, a systematic approach in mind, but also being alive to the tangents that are thrown up, the digressions that are offered to you in the course of your reading, and being alive to following those. So I guess I always start out with a bit of a structure in mind. The first thing was to read him comprehensively, to read all of the novels and the journalism, and then reading around that to read the critical studies of his work, to read the translator's introductions, primarily by Michael Hoffman, but by other translators as well, to speak as well with experts on his life and work. I find that, you know, whenever you write a nonfiction book, you develop a few kind of friendships with people who are experts on your subject, people who can point you in the right direction and become a sounding board as you go along, people that you can approach and say, does this reading of this text feel reasonable or correct to you? And so I guess kind of feeling your way forward between the reading and speaking with people. Mm-hmm. And of course, the other critical thing is traveling, is researching on foot, which mm-hmm. was obviously slightly more complicated than it might have been normally because I wrote this book through the pandemic. Mm-hmm. I started properly in 2018, once I'd got my book deal at the beginning of 2018. And the first thing I wanted to do was to go to Ukraine, go to the little town of Brody, where he was born and grew up. And I did that. I went there early 2019. And of course, I had all these ideas about following his whole life, following in his footsteps, really, across Europe. Mm-hmm. So I was going to go to Ukraine, and then I was going to go to Vienna, I was going to go to Berlin, I was going to go to Paris and Amsterdam and Ostend, all of these key locations in his life. Well, then COVID came along, and in the middle of all of that, I suddenly couldn't really do any of the things that I wanted to. So having got the Ukraine trip done before the pandemic came mm-hmm. along, I then had to write and research remotely for a couple of years, really, all of 2020, most of 2021. And then at the end of 2021, as travel restrictions began to ease a bit, I started hastily, with my deadline looming, I started fitting in some trips at the last minute. So I went to Paris late 2021, November 21. And then January 22, I went to Amsterdam and Ostend as well, thanks to my book's Dutch publishers, Atlas Contact, who very kindly funded a trip for me over there so that I could write more mm-hmm. about his time in the Low Countries, which was a win-win, really. I wanted to be able to do that, but it was also a bonus for them so that I could kind of tailor the book mm-hmm. more to their readership as well. So yeah, really at the last minute, because my deadline was early 2022, mm-hmm. I managed to fit in those trips as well, and the book, I'm sure, benefited from going to those places.
So Paris, I wanted to follow up. I wanted to follow up on this question about traveling to all these places where at some point Joseph Roth lived or worked. So why was it crucial from your perspective, right, to go and experience those physical places, geographical places? And in what way did this trip somehow shape your narrative and your book in general? Whether there were some changes, for instance, as a result of traveling abroad and seeing those places and just, I don't know, just being in those locations.
Yeah, let me think. I'm trying to think what changes there might have been to my understanding of, mm-hmm. of his life as a result of traveling to those places. I mean, I suppose one example would be when I got to Paris. Mm-hmm. I stayed in the hotel that was the first hotel that Roth stayed in when he first came to Paris, first settled there in summer 1925. He and his wife, Friedel, first of all stayed in the Hôtel de la Place de l'Orient in the 6th arrondissement. And it's still functioning, so I thought, well, I've got to stay there. So I stayed there. And it's on the Place de l'Orient, which is, you know, this place, this square, which has streets shooting off in every direction into the left bank. And going there really made me realize how much he would have felt at the heart of things. It's such a beautiful and culturally important location. And you could imagine that he really would have felt the sense of homecoming that you, mm-hmm. you get from his letters that he wrote around that time. You could see why he would have been so excited to arrive there. What a feeling of kind of spiritual and intellectual homecoming he would have felt on arriving there at that time. So that was important. Obviously, going to Broadview was incredibly important. I felt that that should be the first place that I went, and it was. And it really gave me a sense of, you know, how far east he originated from, how far he travelled mm-hmm. in geographical and cultural and intellectual mm-hmm. terms, between his place of origin and the worlds that he worked himself into in Vienna and Berlin and Paris. So to walk those streets and to see the ruins of the Jewish mm-hmm. Eastern Europe that he grew up in, to see that really kind of brought home what this town had been when he lived there, and just how poignant it is that, like so many formerly predominantly Jewish towns in Eastern Europe, it's a, you know, a shadow of what it once was. And so to see the ruins of the synagogue, for example, and to walk the streets and see the signage saying that, you know, there used to be many smaller synagogues and cheders around the streets, just to get the kind of the sense of the remnants of the Jewish
right.
world that once flourished there. I found that very moving, and I think that fed into the earliest parts of the book in particular. Mm-hmm. The other thing to mention is that I did, although I had to cancel a trip to Vienna because they went into lockdown just as I thought I was going to go there, I had at least been there on a stopover on my way back from Ukraine. And I had a few hours where I walked around Leopoldstadt, where Roth lived, and where also, just by the by, it was where my maternal grandparents came from as well. And I guess some of my interest in his life mm-hmm. comes from being interested in my Jewish ancestry on that side and the origins, the world that my grandparents and great-grandparents came from. So I had some time walking around Leopoldstadt, and again, that kind of gave me a sense of the Jewish enclave that he moved into when he first moved to Vienna, and how, although he'd moved from what was Galicia to Vienna, it was still a very Jewish world, but it was a Jewish world, a Jewish quarter within a bigger, more cosmopolitan city, I guess. Mm-hmm. So the travelling was incredibly important, really. I think, you know, it hopefully brings your writing to life. That's the idea anyway, because you go into these places and however much may still be extant from the time that you're writing about, you still get certain feelings that give you a sense of geography, mm-hmm. of atmosphere, of culture. So to walk around Vienna, you get a sense of scale. What else? I mean, it's just things like, it can be things as small as if you walk out of the alleyway that led from the house where Roth grew up onto the street he grew up on, which was then, in German, it was known as Goldgasse. It's now, you might have to correct my pronunciation, but Velizia Zolota, you know, meaning the same thing, kind of golden streets. To walk from the courtyard where the house was through the alley onto the street, and to get the view that he would have seen as he walked out onto the streets as a boy, that kind of thing can really help put you into your subject's perspective. And just, it can be things as little as, you know, that if the sun is kind of shining in a certain direction, then shadows fall in this direction. This side of the street is cast in shadow. The light plays on this kind of facade here. You can see the spire of a church down the road. You know, you get into the perspective. It enables you to write with a bit more atmosphere and colour and just a bit more sense of human experience instead of mm-hmm. writing from afar with a kind of cooler, more detached quality.
Right.
So that's what I'm always aiming for anyway when when I try to write about people. I like to try to get into their world as much as I can.
Mm-hmm. So, and in your book, you track Roth's tortuous identity journey, and you already touched upon this a little bit. So Roth comes from Galicia, travels to Vienna, then Paris, and he did some other traveling as well, including the Soviet Union. So he had a very conflicted as well attitude toward his Eastern Galician Jewishness, which you also write about in your biography. And later he gets fascinated with Austria. He writes in German, and as Hitler rises to power, he at some point is repulsed by his German language. Conflicting attitude to a language resonates with many Ukrainians, for instance, today as a result of Russia's full-scale invasion. So could we take a moment and talk about Roth's abhorrence of German while keeping in mind similar experiences almost 100 years after Roth's experience? So what does language mean to a writer, an individual who feels attacked and violated by language?
I think that's a fascinating question. You have these letters that Roth wrote in the mid-1920s, by which time he was pretty much settled in France. He had kind of fled Germany. He was disgusted by the rise of nationalism and the emerging national socialist movement. And he felt clearly incredibly thwarted by the fact that the only language he spoke well enough to write in was this language that had become to him an embodiment of barbarism. Mm-hmm. So he wrote these letters. There was one where he writes, "German is a dead language." Mm-hmm. And he clearly, he felt repulsed by the fact that he could only kind of think in this language and write in it. You know, it was the only language that he was well enough equipped in to write to his satisfaction. He spoke about half a dozen languages to varying degrees,
right,
but none of the others well enough to create literature.
Mm-hmm.
So he's compelled to write in a language that, for him, by then, has become synonymous with the death of civilization.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he's, you know, it's the only language he can write in. So that must have had some appalling existential effect upon him.
Mm-hmm.
I think he found it really incredibly alienating. Mm-hmm. His thoughts took form in a language that he had come to despise. What do you do when you're in that position? It's, your very innermost sense of self, the way that you think about things, is tainted.
Mm-hmm.
So when we look at the ways in which Roth became so kind of, so fractured and fragmented and torn up inside and mm-hmm. convulsed with self-loathing and also loathing for the world around him as he saw it developing, I think that's probably a significant factor within that process.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really interesting point you raise about Ukraine as well. I mean, I'm not properly qualified to comment on that, mm-hmm. but I'm really interested to hear what you think about what the parallels are there, and what you thought about your and your compatriots' mm-hmm. situation when reading what I had to say in the book about that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, my question was prompted by the fact that after the full-scale invasion that took place last
yeah.
year, many
yeah.
Ukrainians decided to abandon the Russian language because
yeah.
for them, as you just described the response of Joseph Roth, for them, the Russian language in this case became a language of violence. Yes, it became a language of violence. And that kind of violence was felt not only on the linguistic level, but on the somatic level, on the level of their just bodily experiences as well. For this reason, I just wanted to follow up on Roth's ideas and thoughts in relation yeah. to his experience with his language.
Yeah, I think that puts it brilliantly. As you say, it's a somatic level. I mean, it must have been absolutely consuming for him.
Right.
And I think it had a terrible effect on him.
Okay. So he also participated in the First World War, and those impacts were quite traumatic on the one hand. On the other hand, they came to be quite significant for him as a writer. So would you talk a little bit about his experience as a person who participated in the First World War?
Sure. I think the place to start with that is the fact that for the first couple of years of the war, he wasn't involved. He was at university in Vienna when the war broke out. And he and his friend Josef Wittlin, both of them were pacifists, both were students at the university, and both of them felt to begin with that they wanted no part of this war. They felt it was a war launched by the ruling classes, that young men were paying the price for. They resisted against it, but within a couple of years, that position came to feel untenable. On the one hand, they repeatedly saw friends go off to fight and either return terribly injured or not return at all, which was all the more traumatic. They felt increasingly guilty about this. And they also felt by 1916 that perhaps as aspiring writers, fighting in the war might be actually the source of some interesting material for them. And so they were quite clinical about that. They saw it as an exercise in gaining material that would enable them to write firsthand about powerful subjects in a way that they'd not really been able to as students in Vienna previously. So they signed up, or they tried to sign up to fight. They were both kind of quite slight, not physically very well-developed young men, and they were actually turned down by the military doctor, and they had to persuade him to allow them to enlist in the end, and they did manage to enlist. And then, so the latter half of the First World War, Roth served in the Imperial Army. Whether he saw any frontline action is unclear. There's no evidence that he did.
Mm-hmm.
What he seems to have done primarily is to have been a military journalist and censor located mainly in Lemberg, now Lviv. And, he may well have been going out to the front and coming back again. We're just not sure. But regardless, whether he fought or not, what he witnessed during the war and in the aftermath was enough to traumatize him at a very profound level in multiple respects. One, he saw the injuries inflicted upon men of his generation, grotesque, terrible injuries. I mean, there's this incredibly powerful piece of journalism that he wrote in the early 20s, and it describes a funeral parade of injured ex-servicemen following the funeral cortege for a fellow ex-serviceman who had actually publicly committed suicide at a meeting of kind of injured ex-servicemen. I think it was in Lvov, as it was then. And then it was, it was his funeral, and all of these fellow injured ex-servicemen follow the coffin through the streets of the city to the cemetery. And Roth describes them, and it's horrendous. He describes their different terrible injuries in really quite grotesque, compelling ways. And you get a sense very clearly from this article of just how the severity and horror of their injuries imprinted itself on his mind. So that's the kind of particularity of the trauma. But the more general trauma that affected him every bit as much, if not more, was the fact that he lost his home, as he saw it. He lost his homeland.
Mm-hmm.
The homeland that he grew up in, the Habsburg Empire, and the crownland of Galicia that he grew up in, as he later described it, as the only fatherland he ever had. Of course, the Habsburg Empire, dual monarchy, collapsed at the end of the First World War, and with it, the world that Roth had grown up in. And he never really felt he had a home again. He was always looking for a home afterwards. As I said, he felt he had it for a while when he came to Paris, but that kind of, that faded away fairly quickly. And he was always searching for home from that point onwards. But the kind of childhood cradle, as he once described it, of the Habsburg world, when that collapsed and disappeared, it enacted a terrible trauma on him. He felt homeless, he felt rootless. He was kind of literally stateless in the aftermath of the war. He had Polish nationality conferred upon him, but he didn't want that. He wanted to be Austrian. So he then had to apply for Austrian nationality and eventually received it. But then that became quite a saga through the 1920s because he had to prove on a couple of occasions that he really was, he really merited Austrian citizenship in an anti-Semitic environment when the Ostjuden from the former eastern parts of the Austrian Empire were being very looked down upon by many people in Vienna and faced, you know, viewed with anti-Semitic hostility. So he never really had a home again. And that was another aspect of this kind of this great trauma, this great ripping away of the world he had grown up in. So we've seen that the language he grew up learning and speaking and writing in became cold and hostile to him. And the world that he grew up in that seemed like his home collapsed around him as well and vanished. So you can see how he would emerge into that post-war world in the kind of defenseless, vulnerable state that he did and how he became the very troubled person that he did.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
He indeed embraced this sense of homelessness. On the other hand, the way you present him, it looks like he felt at home when writing, and he would feel lost again in the world when he would put his pen down. And his habit of writing was also quite interesting. Public spaces would inspire him, not distract. So would you talk a little bit about Roth's writing routine?
Yeah, I find that fascinating. Mm-hmm. It's so counter to my my needs as a writer. I mean, for me, it's hard enough to write if there's anyone else even kind of moving around in the house when I'm working at home, you know, if I can hear my children kind of talking downstairs and then, you know, I start thinking, even if they're not actively, you know, if the noise isn't actively disrupting, I start thinking, oh, I might get distracted. Mm-hmm. I can't think straight. What if someone comes, you know? And I think many writers are like that. I'm astonished by the fact that for him, I think he, you know, he found silence off-putting and overwhelming. I think he likes a kind of white noise of the kind of hum of a cafe atmosphere around him. He likes people actively talking around him. He likes sitting at a table with friends, and he would move between these states. He would move between chatting with them and then slipping into his writing frame of mind, and then he would kind of return to his article, And then he'd return to conversation for a bit and move back and forth between these states. You know, how you do that, I don't really know, but that was his preferred way of operating. And I suppose what I can understand that you take from that is because he was a writer who was so fascinated by humanity and so attuned to other people, he came to life amongst other people. And he was always on the lookout for little human stories. You know, he developed as a journalist before a novelist, really. And as a journalist, he developed particularly as a practitioner of the feuilleton form, which were these kind of half-page sketches, typically describing, you know, little human encounters, little fleeting moments with universal implications. And so cafe life or street life in the cities of Central and Western Europe after the war lent itself to finding those kind of stories. And so sitting in a cafe with all human life playing out around you and listening in, you know, maybe kind of peeking over the top of your newspaper and listening in to the conversation playing out on the next table, that kind of thing, and then jotting down a few notes and then extrapolating some possible implications and taking an idea for a run and spinning up a whole story, a whole little world. What he called soap bubbles, you know, he had a great way of conjuring up these soap bubbles from very kind of meager origins, just a little comment, a little scene he might have seen somewhere, and suddenly he's playing with these ideas, and he's just incredibly inventive and yet very, very grounded and very acute at the same time. Had this wonderful balance between writing that was very rooted in the here and now, but also playful and inventive and imaginative and speculative as well. In terms of his practice, the more you look at it, the more you can see why actually working in public worked for him. But I just hugely envied his powers of concentration and his sheer kind of doggedness and determination to be able to just lock out what was around him and write, when people were talking in very close quarters to him.
Could we talk a little bit about his relationship with women? So he had quite an ambivalent relationship with his mother. It was some sort between between love and coldness. His relationship with his wife, Friedel Reichler, was also far from being smooth. And she, in fact, proposed to him first, right? But took some time and then left, and later they reunited. And one of Friedel's friends described the woman after a few years of marriage and mentioned that Roth, quote-unquote, ruined her.
So to start with his relationship with his mother, I suppose the place you start with that is the fact that his father went insane before Roth was born, and was taken into psychiatric care first of all, and then lived with a rabbi, a wonder rabbi, who it was hoped might be able to cure him, but as far as we know, never did. And so Joseph Roth never met his father. So there was a great absence where the father might have been. And instead he grows up with his mother, Maria Roth, Neugrubel. And they lived in her father's household on this street, Goldgasse in Brody. And it was an incredibly tight relationship. You know, she understandably didn't want to lose her only child, having lost her husband, his father. And so she was incredibly protective, and this was counterproductive. He wrote in a little kind of reminiscence of childhood of how, and you know, we're never quite sure how true these reminiscences were, because he was a great fantasist and self-fictionalizer. But one of the things he wrote was that he used to quietly kind of get dressed in the small hours of the night and slip out of the house just to wander the streets on his own in order to feel some freedom, mm-hmm. because his mother was so overly solicitous and overbearing, overwhelming. Mm-hmm. She was just kind of, she was always there, cared for him deeply, but this had a counterproductive effect that he felt stifled. And so what he did was he shook her off. He moved from Broady to the University of Lemberg, first of all, didn't stay there very long, then moved to University of Vienna. During the First World War, when she had to go to Vienna as a refugee from the East, they lived together again for a while. But then she returned after the war, and they had very little to do with each other for the rest of her life. She died in 1922, very shortly before he married Friedel. And by that point, they were really quite estranged, and he seems to have transferred his affections, which were already, it's already an ambivalent relationship, he transferred his affections from his mother to his wife. And from that point on was the way to look at his relationship with women, really, is that I think on the one hand he really needed his freedom. He was always very wary of being stifled in any way, as he had been when he was growing up. And on the other hand, he looked to women to serve him, to mm-hmm. kind of to wait on him in the way that his incredibly attentive mother had done. And he was, I mean, you mentioned that he was ambivalent about women. He was, but he was also more than that. I mean, he was, sadly, I came to realize over the course of working on the book, he was just plain misogynistic. Mm-hmm. There's a story called The Triumph of Beauty, which he wrote in the 1930s. And whereas in some of his previous fiction he has seemed to objectify women, to be rather patronizing towards them, not really to inhabit women's perspectives very much in his fiction, in this story it's clear that he despises women. I mean, it's horrible. It's the way that he writes about women is incredibly damning, mocking, belittling. He sees women as the ruin of men. And it's really horrible. It's the one story where you suspect his kind of inner darkest feelings about women are fully manifested. And this was written in the context of his marriage to Friedel having completely broken down in the context of her having gone insane, mm-hmm. as his father went insane, she went insane and was institutionalized. But mm-hmm. her descent into schizophrenia came within a marriage that was horrendous, really. I mean, he was already controlling and belittling towards her. His work always came first, his needs always came first. She was someone who was of anxious disposition and needed stability, needed calmness, needed to be rooted. And instead, what she got was marriage to a man who lived out of three suitcases and lived in perpetual motion, crisscrossing Europe by train, moving from one hotel to another. And she followed in his wake and lived in hotels with him. And it was just too much, I think. It was too unsettling. It was too confusing. And it just amplified her anxiety terribly, and it absolutely broke her. And he wasn't very sympathetic, as far as we can tell. So as her mental health declined, his drinking worsened. His drinking, no doubt, contributed to her mental health declining further. And the two things go hand in hand. And she was institutionalized. He became a fully blown alcoholic. Mm-hmm. And his attitudes towards women from that point onwards were very troubling indeed at times. So, yeah, it's the really the darkest element of his personality that I discovered when really delving into who he was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also wanted to talk a little bit about his trip to the USSR. And he went there as a friend and as a well-known writer, I mean as a friend to the state, but he left as an quote-unquote enemy. What did he see? Why did he turn into this quote-unquote enemy? Of course, his image as an enemy is presented by the Soviets.
Yeah. Why did he turn into an enemy, as they saw it? Well, he was skeptical but interested by the time he got there. As a student, a kind of radical student during the First World War, he was a socialist and something of an anarchist, and you know, someone who was fascinated by the revolution at that point. And then as the 1920s progressed, he became increasingly skeptical. And he was interested to go there to find out more about what was going on. While he was there, he met Walter Benjamin, and they had an evening in Moscow where they were sitting and eating and drinking and talking together. And Benjamin recorded in his diary afterwards, he said, "The long and the short of it, he, Roth, had come to Russia as a (nearly) confirmed Bolshevik and was leaving it a royalist. As usual, the country is left footing the bill for the change in colour that occurs in the convictions of those who arrive here as scintillating reddish-pink politicians under the banner of left-wing opposition or idiotic optimism." Now, I'm not sure if he was a nearly confirmed Bolshevik, but he was kind of sympathetic stroke sceptical. I think he wanted to see the system work well, but was sceptical. What he saw while he was there was enough to make him think, hang on, there's something seriously wrong here. And what I think really troubled him was the way that he saw people learning not to think for themselves. He was very troubled by how he saw people learning, how can I put it? He talks about tinned ideas, kind of prepackaged ideas. And for someone who was, if he was anything, he was a free thinker. He became a great individualist. He was a liberal in the end. He was very concerned with freedom, with having the capacity to think for oneself. And he was very alarmed by the way he saw people being trained to think in correct ways, to know what to say. How to say the right things that would enable them to progress within the Soviet system, but not actually being able to think critically, to have any skepticism, to think for themselves. I think that troubled him deeply. You can see that as well in the novel that he wrote while he was traveling in the USSR and afterwards, Flight Without End. He'd obviously also picked up on the paranoia that people felt about the fact that people all around them could be informing on them, that you couldn't really trust anybody. So I think those two things put together left him very, very troubled by what he saw. And it was a critical part of the process, the pivoting that he went through in this point from having been socialist stroke communist to returning to the monarchism of his youth. He grew up very much admiring the Habsburgs, and deviated from that a bit as a young man, and then returned to basically being a kind of conservative Habsburg royalist, really, who from the early 1930s onwards was increasingly convinced that Europe's salvation lay in restoring the Habsburg monarchy. He thought that was the only way of keeping nationalism and particularly Nazism at bay by returning the Habsburgs to the throne. And that became one of his great obsessions in his final decade. Mm-hmm. So the 6 months that he spent in the Soviet Union was really pivotal and fundamental to setting him on that course that became so definitive for the rest of his life.
So what was the most difficult, challenging part to write about while you were structuring this biography?
Ooh, it's a good question. what was the most difficult part? Well, I suppose I was most conscious of really wanting to get the section on the Radetzky March right. Mm-hmm. So that felt difficult in that I felt like this is his great book. I've got to get this right. And it's the heart of my book, really, writing about that. It's the apex of his achievements. I have to reflect. I have to show how great it was and how just the part it played in his career as a novelist. I felt I really had to get that right. Was that the hardest to write about, though? I mean, I felt quite inspired while I was writing about it, because it's such a great book. And it's so fascinating to write about, which obviously it sparks off ideas.
Yeah.
And is interesting, enjoyable to write about. What was the hardest to write about? Maybe it was the sections, I would guess maybe a quarter of the way into the book, where I'm having to set out the intellectual ground, the cultural context in which we need to understand his sense of self as an Eastern Jew in that time and place. Mm-hmm. So where I was trying to make clear the tensions operating within him, the pulls between East and West, the feelings of admiration that he had for the Ostjuden of the Galician world that he grew up in, but also the admiration he had for Vienna, the world of the Habsburgs, the world that he wanted to assimilate into, how torn and pulled he felt between those. And there's sections of the book there that I had to write without a huge amount of narrative. And I always want to try to get the discussion of ideas, to work through the ideas in the course of storytelling, of staying within a narrative. I couldn't always do that there. And I suppose there were some bits there where I felt like, am I getting a little bit boxed down here? Or I feel this is ground that needs to be covered, but is this a little bit of me saying to the reader, bear with me here, we need to get through this stuff before we can get back to the narrative moving at pace. Mm-hmm. I was never quite sure if I pulled that off entirely. I think that was probably the hardest bit. Mm-hmm. There's a certain amount there of, hello, reader, bear with me here. We've got to understand this stuff. So please, let's understand this, let's understand that. And then, you get back to, it's pretty much the First World War, really. From that point onwards, I'd like to think the narrative doesn't really stop. There's always one thing moves to the next thing, moves to the next thing, which was part of the great pleasure for me as a biographer. He had such a dynamic life, and it was so littered with consequential incidents and episodes. So you could say, this happened, which made this happen, which made this happen. And it's a very propulsive life. He was a biographer's dream, really. But that would be the hardest bit. That kind of intellectual scene setting that I had to do around a quarter of the way in. Yeah.
Are you working on a new biography at the moment?
No, I'm not. No. I'm not working on anything at the moment. I'm not writing anything at the moment. I'm teaching primarily. when I do write something else, I'm thinking it might not be a biography next.
Mm-hmm.
I've just written two biographies back to back. All told, they've taken me about 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
And they've both been absolutely fascinating and involving. And I've loved writing them both. But I feel like the next thing I need to do needs to be fresh and different, and conceptually something quite different. So I'm toying with the idea of a kind of social history. I'm not going to say anymore because it's actually too vague in my head to talk about really anyway. But I haven't got far with that yet anyway. I'm hoping to get it moving later in the year, perhaps.
Well,
but for the moment, the focus is on teaching, really. And, you know, I'm still talking about this book a fair bit, and I'm not someone who's very good at working up and writing, you know, one book idea when I've still got a head full of the previous book. Roth would have been brilliant at that, I'm sure. He was always working on multiple book ideas, and, you know, he was finishing one while he was selling the idea mm-hmm. for the next and pocketing the advance, and then... And on we go, but I can't operate like that, I'm afraid. I'm still letting go of this book.
So, and you're teaching creative writing courses, and do you have an opportunity of speaking about Joseph Roth, for instance, in your courses or somehow?
I do sometimes. I mean, it's not woven into the curriculum in mm-hmm. any ways, but sometimes... In the past year or so, I've said to my students, I can give you an example of such mm-hmm. and such. When I'm teaching, I primarily teach on the MA in biography and creative nonfiction at the University of East Anglia here in Norwich. And sometimes I've been able to say to my students, here's an example from my experience of writing my book about Joseph Roth. And when I was teaching a different module last spring, we were talking a bit about the new journalism and Tom Wolfe, and we talked a bit about Joan Didion and Hunter S. Thompson and all of that context. And mm-hmm. I thought it would be interesting for my students then to look at the kind of very personal journalism, personalized journalism that Roth was writing 40 or 50 years before that school of American writers. Mm-hmm. So I sent them some of his feuilletons to look at, and that was quite productive as well. But that was supplementary reading, really. Not really woven into the curriculum, but more supplementary contextual reading, stroke experience. Mm-hmm. And because some of what I teach is about, you know, the practice of writing biography and creative nonfiction, as well as analysing specific texts. Having written this book and the previous book and having been a journalist for 25 years, I can talk to them a fair bit about interviewing techniques
mm-hmm.
and archival research and footstepping, you know, getting out into the locations, all of these things that were useful to me as a journalist, but also while writing this book. And so Roth has come up in that context as well at times. So I kind of get him in there whenever I can. I feel quite evangelical about him. You know, I've quite often told my students, if you like this kind of thing, then you must read Joseph Roth, because he's brilliant. And, you know. So yeah, I get him in there when I can anyway.
Yeah, sure. Well, thank you so much, Kieran, for this conversation today. And thank you so much for your book that really offers this captivating portrait of Joseph Roth. And also your book, once again, illuminates all those political, historical, and cultural complexities of the first half of the 20th century. And your book really also reveals how those complexities impact the individual. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Natalia. I very much appreciate your kind words about it, and you've just summed up exactly what I was trying to do in the book. So I'm really pleased to gather that you think it succeeded in that respect. And I'm most grateful to you for inviting me onto the podcast. So thank you.
Thank you. Today I spoke with Kieran Pem about his recent book, Endless Flight, The Life of Joseph Roth, published by Granta Book in 2022. Thank you for listening to New Books in Literary Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.